This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ladies of the Canyons, a League of Extraordinary Women and Their Adventures in the American Southwest, by Leslie Poling Kempes, narrated by Joanna Perrin. Prologue. Ladies of the Canyons. I began the quest for the Ladies of the Canyons more than a decade ago. At the time, I was looking for a woman who had gone missing in history. Her name was Carol Bishop Stanley, and although she was the founder of Ghost Ranch, the place that would achieve celebrity status as the faraway, nearby home of the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe, there was little to nothing written about Carol in the Ghost Ranch story. From oral histories and a handful of written accounts and letters, I learned that in 1931, Carol, a middle-aged divorcee from Boston, moved all that she owned to El Rancho de los Brujos, the Ranch of the Witches, the place she called Ghost Ranch, and with limited financial resources, set about creating a home on the high desert of northern New Mexico. But how and why this woman had come to live in this austere, remote, and wildly beautiful landscape was lost to living memory. O'Keeffe never acknowledged Carol's role in the creation of Ghost Ranch, but that was in character, since O'Keeffe rarely acknowledged that anyone, male or female, held a prior claim to Ghost Ranch, although she herself never legally owned more than 10 of the ranch's nearly 30,000 acres. Arthur Pack, the millionaire who bought the ranch from Carol in 1935, did mention Carol Pfaffel, her married name, in his memoir, We Called It Ghost Ranch, and in doing so, provided some of the only recorded glimpses of her life. Close in, under the sheltering protection of magnificent buttes and sheer sandstone cliffs, huddled a single, low adobe building whose every door and window staggered crookedly. From it appeared a woman who spoke in cultured tones, unmistakably Bostonian. This homestead, which her ex-husband was said to have won in a poker game, was all that Carol Pfaffel had left in the world, except for a beautiful grand piano. Pack likely knew more about Carol's life than he shared in his memoir. Like how a cultured woman from Boston came to be living alone, with a grand piano, in a decrepit homestead on the edge of the Colorado Plateau, in the first years of the Depression. But Pack, like most chroniclers of his era, did not consider the immigration story of an ordinary woman worthy of more than a passing reference that gave context to his own story. When you go looking for missing persons, you may not find them, the historian Virginia Scharf wrote, but you are bound to find out a lot of other things. I did find Carol Stanley. I also found a lot of other people and things I did not even know to go looking for. While searching archives and public records for Ghost Ranch's founding mother, I discovered a narrative that connected Carol to an informal alliance of remarkable women. Women who, like Carol, had left the security and comfort of conventional society in the first decades of the 20th century and journeyed to Indian country in search of a wider, deeper view of themselves and the world. Natalie Curtis Berlin, Alice Ellen Clauber, Mary Cabot Wheelwright, and Carol Bishop Stanley were members of an intrepid group of ladies whose lives became entwined with and altered by the people and landscape of the Southwest Outback. Their ranks included Louisa Wade Wetherill, Alice Corbin Henderson, Elsie Clues Parsons, the sisters Amelia Elizabeth and Martha Root White, Mabel Dodge Lujan, Margretta Dietrich, Mary Austin, Elsie Shepley Sargent, and Willa Cather. Unearthing Carol Stanley's half-century-long journey from her grandfather's beach house on Nahant Island, Massachusetts, to the ramshackle outpost built in Yeso Canyon, New Mexico, by infamous cattle rustlers, meant following a road through the Southwest blazed by plucky and resourceful women. Within this landscape, they imagined and created a new home territory, a new society, and a new identity for themselves and for all the women who would follow them. The saga that emerged was far greater than Carol Stanley and Ghost Ranch. The story of the Lady of the Canyon became the stories of the Ladies of the Canyons and included Boston Brahmins and the Greenwich Village avant-garde, New York's Armory Show, and the birth of modern art, a president and Indian music. The snake dance at Walpi and the Ute battle at Cottonwood Gulch, San Diego's Balboa Park and Santa Fe's Museum of Art, Florence before World War I, and Paris in the Roaring Twenties. It was the story of new women stepping bravely into the new world, of Anglo-America waking up to Native America, of inconspicuous success and ambitious failure. My thoughts now are the thoughts of a stone, Alice Corbin wrote after her move to New Mexico in 1916. My substance now is the substance of life itself. Herein is the story of the ladies of the canyons, nearly buried by negligence and the inevitable avalanche of the decades that quietly claim the details and narratives of even remarkable lives. The ladies' trail remains true and shows the way into the vast territory of stone and sky and untold history. 1. Imperfectly independent. No one can predict at the outset where the life stream will lead, but those moments of fissure, rupture, diversion, and frustration require choice and can even become springboards to opportunity. Virginia Scharf. On a spring morning in 1903, Natalie and George Curtis walked together down a dusty street in the border town of Yuma, Arizona, as far south and west as one could wander in the continental United States. Dressed in expedition khaki and wide-brimmed hats to shade their pale faces, their leather boots colored by the fine sand of the Sonoran Desert, Natalie and George talked and laughed with the comfortable ease of good friends, or sister and brother. They were both. George DeCliver Curtis was tall and lanky, with an amiable, welcoming manner. His younger sister Natalie was blonde and petite, with intense blue eyes and an easy, contagious smile. The Curtis siblings were newcomers to Yuma, gringos off the train. Their appearance certainly gave them away, as did their accents, upper-class eastern seaboard with the diction of the Greenwich Village, Washington Square blue blood, laced with the soft R acquired in Harvard Yard and the parlors of the Boston Brahmins. How had these two aristocratic Anglo-Americans come to be renting rooms in a flea-bitten, cactus- and snake-infested railway settlement on the farthest uncivilized edge of the great American desert? Although the Colorado River irrigated a narrow corridor along the town's edge, Yuma was derided as the hottest, driest hellhole in the desert southwest. It was not a particularly attractive or remarkable landscape, not like the iconic Indian country of chiseled spires and carved canyons to the north. And there was no culture or industry here beyond the railroad yard and the fenced fortress of the state penitentiary. The community's population comprised Spanish Americans who lived on the Arizona side of the Colorado River and the thousand or so Quichon Indians who lived on their reservation on the California side. Natalie Curtis was 27 in the spring of 1903 on her inaugural journey into the vast, wild territory of the American Southwest. Her brother, George DeCliver Curtis, was 32. George had come alone to Arizona in the winter of 1900, looking for reprieve from debilitating asthma. George found his good health and a lifestyle that suited him on an Arizona ranch, and was a renewed man when he returned for a visit to the Curtis home in Greenwich Village a year later. Natalie, herself in poor physical and emotional condition, saw the remarkable changes in her older brother and decided she too needed to experience the healing air and light of southern Arizona. Natalie, George, and their siblings Constance, Bridgem, and Marion, an older sister Julia, died as a child, enjoyed every advantage available to those born into Victorian New York City's upper class. In the family brownstone at 27 Washington Place, the Curtis children were surrounded by New York City's cultural and intellectual elite. Their father, Edward Curtis, called Bogey by Natalie, was a distinguished doctor on the faculty of the College of Physicians and Surgeons and had served on the staff of the Army Surgeon General during the Civil War. Mother Augusta, known as Mimsy, oversaw a household where everyone in the family circle excelled at something. Overachievers were the norm at the informal and animated family suppers of the Washington Place dining table. Boldness and self-confidence were encouraged in the Curtis household, even among the women, and success in a chosen endeavor a given, at least among the men. George and Bridgem were Harvard educated, an option not available to Natalie, her sisters Connie and Marion, or any other women in Victorian America, until she climbed aboard the train that would take her to the desert in 1902. Natalie had lived most of her life within the warm, comfortable, but confining rooms of the Washington Place house, where she was born in 1875. She did travel abroad with her family and attended the Brearley School, a private day school for privileged girls. Music was considered a female-appropriate educational pursuit and was also an important social grace for upper-class Victorian women. Natalie's education included piano lessons when she was a very young child. There was always music in the home, Natalie's brother Bridgem remarked years later. Music and music teachers. Soon music was all Natalie cared and talked about. A visit with little Natalie Curtis meant an afternoon of piano duets and song. Natalie's young voice was trained in Anton Seidel's festival chorus, which accompanied the New York Philharmonic, and she was a featured soloist with the National Conservatory Chorus. She took piano classes with the great Antonín Dvořák at the Conservatory of Music and studied privately with the German composer, Arthur Freedom, and the Italian composer, Ferruccio Busoni, both of whom had studied in Europe with Franz Liszt. By her teen years, Dr. Curtis's daughter Natalie was recognized as one of the most talented and serious young pianists, male or female, in New York City. Although her father was not the Wagnerian enthusiast that Natalie was, Bogey and Natalie were in the audience for every one of Wagner's operas performed at the Metropolitan Opera House. Bogey often regretted taking Natalie to the Met, however, because she became so emotionally involved and musically stimulated. At the end of one Wagner opera, when the audience broke into applause, Natalie zealously pounded the opera house floor with a crutch. She had a lame leg at the time, until Bogey reached over and snatched the wood stick from her hands. "Papa says that music is a bad habit with me," she wrote a girlfriend, "and that I am nothing more nor less than a musical drunkard." While her contemporaries had crushes on stage actors, Natalie's infatuations involved opera singers, pianists, and conductors. At 17, she was smitten by Walter Damrosch, a handsome, enigmatic, married, and very popular among the women, Wagnerian conductor. Damrosch, who Natalie nicknamed It and described as Adonis-like in her letters to her friend Bessie, was 10 years Natalie's senior. Even so, Natalie managed to attract the celebrity conductor's eye, and in the early 1890s, the two began a friendship that would last several decades. By her 18th birthday, Natalie was a musical tour de force, whose entire life was organized around music. 4 to 6 hours of piano practice was the norm, with choral classes, voice, and harmony lessons fitted in around schoolwork several times each week. A rigorous daily practice schedule, devised and enforced by Natalie, so wore down the patience and frayed the nerves of the Curtis family that a toneless practice clavier was placed on Natalie's keyboard to mute the sound, and eventually she was given a technophone keyboard that made only soft clicks. Natalie's punishing schedule never stopped, even during holidays at the Curtis summer home Wavecrest in Far Rockaway, Long Island. While George and her other siblings went swimming and boating, rode horses and sunned on the beach, Natalie commuted into the humid, hot city for her piano lessons. She practiced 6 to 7 hours daily at Wavecrest, and when she wasn't practicing, Natalie was consuming the works of Goethe, Tennyson, Keats, and Schopenhauer. Natalie's zealous commitment to her music and her inability to moderate that commitment would be responsible for her greatest achievements and most devastating disappointments. Half-hearted was not in her psyche or her vocabulary. The relentless routine she maintained at Wavecrest threatened her health, and exhaustion spawned depression and doubt. Still, she persisted with her routine, even using brandy and strong coffee to get through her lessons. Finally, Mimsy and Bogey said enough, and Natalie was sent to the Berkshire Hills in Massachusetts for rest and recovery. At 18, Natalie was the age when women were expected to marry, not begin careers as concert pianists. Natalie's parents understood that their daughter's talent was worthy of the professional stage. They understood, too, that a woman, a proper woman, did not choose the stage over marriage and a family. But the world was about to undergo a cultural revolution, and educated, talented, ambitious young women like Natalie Curtis but find themselves among the vanguard who would, almost in spite of themselves, untie the stays and dismantle the walls that defined Victorian American women. Natalie, just 16, wrote a friend, "I don't know myself, but I want to have a kind of profession just as a man would, so that I could be perfectly independent. Don't you think that it would be awful to feel as some girls do that they must marry, just as though they were so many cows?" But for all her bravado and progressivism, Natalie was conflicted about the implications of a career. If she were a concert pianist, she would have to leave home, and unless she was married, a woman, even a gifted one, did not leave home to pursue a profession in the 1890s. "I feel very well that my place is at home, in my family," Natalie wrote Bessie in 1893. "I know that Papa would feel my absence tremendously, and I owe him so much that I can never pay him, that the least I can do is to stay with him if my presence give him any pleasure." Leaving Mimsy and Bogey to go out into the world, Natalie confided to her girlfriend, would make her feel like an ungrateful hog. George graduated from Harvard that year, and not burdened by his younger sister's sense of debt or duty to Mimsy and Bogey, began a career as a librarian at the Astor Library in New Haven, Connecticut. The Curtis home breathed of liberal reform, practical idealism, moral courage, and love of the fine arts. Located two blocks from Washington Square, Natalie's world was the invigorating, upscale, fashionable, semi-bohemian community of Greenwich Village. Henry James was born a few doors down at 21 Washington Place, and the Vanderbilts lived in the next block at number 10. The Curtis brownstone had been the family home since Natalie's grandfather bought it in 1839. Natalie's father and his four brothers spent their childhoods in the quiet, gracious neighborhood. The older Curtis boys married or went off to the Civil War, and Bogey, the youngest, inherited the house on Washington Place, where he settled with his wife Augusta and raised Natalie and her siblings. The impetus for Natalie and George's unconventional journey into the rugged outback of the American West could be at least partly attributed to the example set by their father's half-brother, George William Curtis. The influence of Uncle George on the character and imagination of Natalie in particular cannot be overstated. George Curtis was a remarkable individual, and his life would serve as a template for his niece, who shared his spirited sense of adventure, sharp intellect, welcoming manner, and tactful but resolute temperament. George Curtis, 20 years Bogey's senior, was more of a grandfather than an uncle to the Curtis children. Although he never attended college, by the 1880s, George Curtis held honorary degrees from Harvard, Brown, and Columbia, and was the chancellor of the University of the State of New York. He was a self-taught scholar, an insatiable seeker, and a prolific writer who for 20 years was a popular and influential political editor at Harper's Weekly. Although George Curtis had homes near Boston and on Staten Island, he was an experienced outdoorsman who encouraged Natalie and George to learn about the simple joys found in a life lived close to the land. As a young man, he was introduced to the gifts of nature at Brook Farm, where he was schooled in transcendentalism by Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, and their League of New England Poet-Farmers and Philosophers. George Curtis's friends came to include the literary elite and politically powerful of his time. Fluent in four languages, he taught himself Italian, French, and German. He traveled the world in his 20s before returning to the United States and settling into a career as a political writer. Although George Curtis was always comfortable in the company of writers, his closest acquaintances were Irving, Bryant, Lowell, Thackeray, and Longfellow. By the Civil War, he had become a respected and high-profile American statesman, and had twice served as a delegate at Republican national conventions. In 1869, he was offered, but turned down, the nomination to be Secretary of State under President Grant. A fervent supporter and promoter of Abraham Lincoln, George Curtis was devastated by the president's assassination. Both George Curtis and Natalie's father gazed upon the slain body of President Lincoln. George Curtis as a colleague and devotee at the memorial service, Bogey as a member of the Surgeon General's team at the autopsy. Like many of their neighbors in Greenwich Village, the Curtises lost several family members in the Civil War, including Bogie's brother and George Curtis's stepbrother Joe, a lieutenant colonel who fell in the Battle of Fredericksburg. George Curtis's brother-in-law, Robert Shaw, was just 27 when he died at the head of his regiment, the famous Massachusetts 54th, the first all-Negro regiment in the Civil War. Colonel Shaw and his troops stormed Fort Wagner in South Carolina on July 18, 1863. One-fourth of the regiment fell that day. Shaw was among the first killed, and the victorious Confederates stripped, robbed, and buried his body in a mass grave with his Negro comrades. When Uncle George's wife, Anna Shaw, and her family learned of Robert's dishonorable burial in South Carolina, the Army offered to disinter his body and return it to Boston for a proper burial with full honors. Shaw's father, Frank, responded, "We can imagine no holier place than that in which he lies, among his brave and devoted followers, nor wish for him better company." A confirmed independent by the 1880s, George Curtis's weekly political column in Harper's reached tens of thousands of devoted readers. With the spoken and written word his platform of choice, the gentle, even-tempered George Curtis had a big manner, Walt Whitman wrote of his friend. And without being offish, his personality had a large swing, as if it had plenty of time and space in which to live. Fireside chats in the Curtis parlor in Greenwich Village were attended by the progressive individuals who were reshaping American principles, politics, and aesthetics in the second half of the 19th century. Natalie's civic and cultural education and her moral conscience were supplemented and influenced by the conversations and activities of her Uncle George and his famous peers, who debated political theory and social and educational reform around the Curtis dinner table. For the precocious and gifted Natalie, George William Curtis exemplified a life devoted to intellectual exploration, creative expression, social reform, and the unrestrained pursuit of one's passion. Natalie adored him, and as she grew into maturity as a musician and a woman, and struggled to find her place, and to leave home to find that place, in the new world of the 20th century, Uncle George's spoken and written wisdom guided her choices and bolstered her resolve. Mainstream Protestantism was undergoing challenge from unconventional and esoteric religious movements in the 1890s. Natalie and Mimsy attended meetings of the Theosophical Society that introduced Buddhism, Sufism, and Hinduism to New York's upper class. Theosophy encouraged the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science, and also endorsed the concepts of karma and reincarnation. Life was not haphazard, but part of a grand scheme. Theosophy affirmed teenage Natalie's intuition that her art and her life were one, and that music was her divine destiny. Natalie was more than a coming-of-age feminist. She was an emerging humanist. Where traditional Anglo-centric Americans saw the other in race, religion, and culture, Natalie recognized common ground. It was a perspective that would cause her to challenge conventional ideology and push her to pursue a destiny far from Washington Square in the exotic and uncivilized territory of Native America. In the summer of 1896, Natalie went to Europe with her brother George. She was 21, and it was her second journey across the Atlantic. Natalie and George traveled to London, through the Rhine region of Germany, and across Italy. By late fall, the siblings had settled into rooms in Paris, where George enrolled at the École des Beaux-Arts, and Natalie was accepted into voice classes at the revered Paris Conservatory. It was to be a winter devoted to study and creative stimulation, but it all came to an end when Natalie suffered an acute attack of appendicitis. Mimsy boarded the first ship to France and took Natalie by train to Switzerland for medical treatment. After Natalie recovered her health, Natalie and Mimsy journeyed to Bayreuth, Wagner's home, another Mecca for all things Wagnerian, and Natalie enrolled to study the operas she had loved since childhood. Natalie's reputation as an accomplished young American pianist opened doors to Bayreuth's inner circle of musicians and socialites, and Natalie and her mother were introduced to Wagner's widow, Cosima, with whom they spent a memorable New Year's Eve, 1896. Back in residence at Washington Place that spring, Natalie received an invitation from her former teacher, Anton Seidel, to perform a piano concerto with the Philharmonic Orchestra. Natalie, now 22, was straddling two worlds, the world of the professional paid musician and the world of a proper single woman who lived at home with her parents. Seidel recognized an enormous talent in Natalie Curtis and urged her to take her place on the professional stage. The invitation flattered, even as it terrified Natalie. She understood that although she would be equal to and respected by New York's top musicians, her professional career would be limited by her gender. She also understood that she would be expected to step down from the professional stage when she married, and if she did not marry, she would be sentenced to the life at the periphery of conventional society, experienced by all single women who dared to pursue their creative passion. Seidel's invitation to join him on the professional stage pushed Natalie's conflicts to the surface. Even in a progressive household like the Curtises, it was understood that daughters would marry and raise a family. Even an accomplished musician like Natalie was biding her time until she was betrothed. As a married woman with children, she could teach music and continue to play publicly, but not for pay. Music would become her hobby, not her vocation. Natalie's passion for music, indeed for anything, would have no place in a Victorian woman's home. Natalie's fate as a concert pianist was not decided by intellectual debate within the Curtis family or in private conversations with her mentors and friends. Instead, it was Natalie's obsessive demand for musical excellence that ended her dream of becoming a professional musician. A debilitating daily practice routine, coupled with the sobering reality that her artistic dreams were laden with uncertainty, broke Natalie's health, and she collapsed in the fall of 1897. George claimed his sister's concert career ended with a strained hand due to overzealous piano practice. Bridgham's account of Natalie's collapse was less specific about the cause, but he too acknowledged the magnitude of that moment in Natalie's life. While preparing for the most important concert of her young life, Natalie suffered nothing less than a severe physical breakdown that made all thought of a career as a pianist out of the question. It was a line of demarcation in the life of Natalie Curtis. She was as emotionally devastated as she was physically broken. Hindsight suggests that Natalie understood the confines of the cultural prison that she, even as the daughter of progressive parents, was sentenced to accept. Natalie's physical and emotional withdrawal from the performance with the Philharmonic avoided a head-on collision between the reality that was a proper woman's place in upper-class New York society and the artistic path she had dreamed of and pursued since childhood. Natalie had no helpful mentors and no answers, personally or professionally. What she needed was to retreat to a cabin in the woods near a place like Walden Pond, where she could find solace and glean wisdom from the elders. But the elder who could have given Natalie an astute and hopeful perspective on life and art, on the individual's path and the grand scheme, her Uncle George, had been dead for 5 years. Natalie's convalescence was slow. She remained in the brownstone on Washington Place, and although she was physically unable to play the piano, began to compose pieces for voice, piano, and violin. Gradually, her strength returned, and she played a little piano and sang her new songs for family gatherings. But her grand and passionate dreams of a career under the lights of the world's great concert halls were snuffed. "Whenever she played, her touch was sensitive and lovely," George wrote, "and her voice, whether in singing or in lecturing, had a sweet and moving quality of its own." Natalie was an adept composer, and several of her first compositions were published by G. Schirmer. "Deepest Where Thy Shadow Falls," published in 1898, and "Song from Pippa Passes" in 1899. One long composition based on the poems of Robert Louis Stevenson, "Songs from a Child's Garden of Verses," was published in 1902. Natalie seemed resigned to the life of an unambitious introvert, considering the world-renowned maestros she had trained with and the prestigious concert hall she had performed in. Playing a little piano and singing a few songs for an audience of close friends and family must have been as satisfying to Natalie Curtis as a trot among the stable ponies would be for a derby-trained thoroughbred. Natalie was a finely honed artist of unquestioned brilliant promise, who seemed to have lost her confidence and gumption. At 25 years of age, she was grappling with the dark night of the soul. George returned from Europe and his studies at the Beaux-Arts and settled into life in New Haven. His job in the stacks of the Astor Library suited him, but the damp climate of New England aggravated his asthma, and in 1900, worn down by frequent and incapacitating attacks, George did what ailing men of means could choose to do. He quit his job, packed his bags, and boarded a train for the arid, pristine air of the American West. The Curtis family had friends and relatives in the Los Angeles area, but George went to rural Arizona and looked for work in the small towns along the Santa Fe Railway. Although his equestrian skills were limited and his knowledge of cows nil, George was hired by one of the large cattle outfits. Life in the saddle under the big sky of the West, a life of long days on horseback, short nights on the hard ground, with meals cooked on a campfire, rehabilitated his body and stimulated his mind in much the same manner as the life on Brook Farm had restored and inspired his Uncle George. To Bogey and Mimsy Curtis and their friends on the eastern seaboard, the American Southwest was an exotic territory at its best and an uncivilized, even savage frontier at its worst. The Public Relations Department of the Santa Fe Railway was working overtime at the turn of the century to change Anglo-America's perception of the southwestern United States. In pamphlets and newspaper articles, the American public was told to see America first, and that the landscape and indigenous cultures of the western half of the continent were as exotic, dynamic, and worthy of exploration as anything found in Europe or the Middle East. Throughout 1900 and 1901, George sent letters and picture postcards of his travels through California and Arizona, home to Natalie and the family in New York. His words and images sparked Natalie's dulled imagination and diminished spirit. And although a call to adventure was not a conventional choice for a 27-year-old woman, especially if she were single and of dubious health, Natalie announced in 1902 that she wanted to join George out west. Bogey and Mimsy, painfully aware that Natalie was not recovering her stamina and her famously energetic joie de vivre, sequestered within the rooms of the Washington Place brownstone, consented to her request. George came east for a family visit in the fall, and when he boarded the train west again, Natalie was at his side. The siblings went to Southern California and stayed with family friends near Los Angeles, where the winter weather was balmy and bright. On New Year's Day 1903, Natalie and George went to Pasadena for the outdoor celebrations and events associated with the Tournament of Roses. There, a new friend, Charles Lummis, invited them to an event showcasing Navajo singers from Arizona. The Navajos had been invited to Los Angeles by the controversial author, editor, and outdoorsman, Charles Fletcher Lummis, and were camped on land near his home, El Alisal, in Pasadena. It is possible that Lummis, a political activist and journalist, had known Natalie and George's uncle, George William Curtis, years before in Boston. Lummis was born and raised in Massachusetts and had attended Harvard, where his classmates included Theodore Roosevelt. By 1903, and Natalie's arrival in Los Angeles, Lummis's The Land of Poco Tiempo had been in print for a decade. The book was a popular success and practically required reading for Yankee tourists and everyone else who ventured to see America first, the phrase coined by Lummis, and make the bold journey into the Southwest. Lummis's episodic narrative about the land of Pretty Soon, the territory of New Mexico, introduced Americans like Natalie to the people, geography, history, and essence of the Southwest. Lummis was a disciple of the open-air, close-to-the-earth lifestyle championed by Thoreau, Emerson, and John Burroughs, and advocated by Uncle George, and had walked the length of New England as an undergrad. In 1884, at the age of 25, Lummis left his desk job at the Scioto, Ohio Gazette and began a trek. He called it a tramp across the American continent. Following railroad lines and wagon roads where they could be found, Lummis walked 3,507 miles in 143 days. His destination was Los Angeles, and his 6 million footsteps wove through natural and cultural wonders in Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and finally Southern California. Lummis's tramp included stopovers at the pueblos of Tizuque and Isleta in New Mexico, and his time living among the natives of these ancient villages had redirected the course of his life and work. At dinner parties and social events at El Alisal, place of the Sycamores, in the hills east of Los Angeles, Natalie and George were introduced to the Los Angeles artists, intellectuals, and social reformers who congregated at Lummis's home. It was a lively introduction to the rich, complicated, and many-layered cultural and political society of the 20th century Southwest. El Alisal was a cozy, rustic, enchanting adobe and stone home, hand-built by Lummis and his native friends in the oak, cactus, and sagebrush Arroyo Seco near Pasadena, later called Highland Park. The house was striking in style and character and would be recognized as among the first to exhibit the no-frills, clean, clutter-free, close-to-nature design, construction, and interior decor aesthetic of the California arts and crafts movement. Natalie was plunged into a new visual, cultural, and intellectual environment at El Alisal. Lummis, like Natalie, was driven by a hunger in the head, a passionate need to explore the whys and wherefores of the world. Editor of Out West magazine, Lummis was the national spokesman for the paradise he had found in California. His clean, straightforward prose about the idyllic life and pristine landscape found out west was nearly as responsible as the Santa Fe Railway's promotion department for the mass immigration of artists, writers, health seekers, and adventurers into the Southwest in the first decades of the 20th century. Lummis told stories about roaming the Pajarito, Little Bird Plateau, in New Mexico with the great Swiss archaeologist Adolf F. Bandelier. On foot, on horseback, and on burro, Lummis and Bandelier explored the canyon and mountain country west of the old city of Santa Fe, the region known as El Rito de los Frijoles, Creek of the Beans, that would one day become Bandelier National Monument. Thousands of miles of wilderness and desert we trudged side by side, Lummis wrote of his days with Bandelier. Camped, starved, shivered, learned, and were glad together. Natalie had enjoyed the out-of-doors in New England and on the Atlantic coast, and she had twice crossed the Atlantic and stayed in Paris, the Swiss Alps, and the lush German forests near Bayreuth. But Lummis described a landscape, the likes of which she had never seen or even imagined, a place that was a picture, a romance, a dream, a land of ineffable lights and sudden shadows, where the rattlesnake is a demigod and the cigarette a means of grace, the heart of Africa beating against the ribs of the Rockies. At their home in the Los Angeles foothills, Lummis and his wife Eva held dinner parties and noises, salons, to which artists, writers, politicians, and activists regularly flocked. Newcomers like Natalie and George mingled with the great, the near great, the merely colorful, and assorted hangers-on, who on any given night could include John Muir, John Burroughs, and a California labor and Indian rights activist, suffragette, and writer named Mary Austin. Lummis and his friends were involved in the roiling cauldron of Indian rights, and with their Sequoia League, founded in 1902, were active participants in the heated national political debate surrounding Indian reform policies. Lummis used the pages of Out West magazine to criticize Washington's Indian education programs and took his grievances about federal Indian programs, especially the Indian boarding schools, to his college pal, President Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was frequently peeved and even outraged by Lummis and the Sequoia League's methods of activism. But to his Washington staff's chagrin, the president welcomed the provocative California writer into the White House. Through Lummis, Natalie was introduced into the society, issues, and people of Southern California. California was a foreign country with its own traditions, history, and lifestyle. Even the lively salons in Arroyo Seco had an unmistakably Western flair. Lummis's wardrobe of choice, even for visits to the White House, was a Spanish bolero jacket, corduroy trousers and matching sport coat, and leather moccasins with a wide sash around his waist and a colored kerchief knotted about his head or neck. Khaki skirts and riding slacks, cowboy boots, Levi's, broad-brimmed hats, and colorful ties and belts were the norm for California women and men. The staid attire and formal social graces deemed proper and acceptable back in New York and Boston had no place in Southern California. Natalie had stepped into a new world, and her body, mind, and spirit responded with vigor and enthusiasm to the myth and the reality of the American West. Lummis was not a musician, but he had been collecting and recording the folk music of the Spanish and the indigenous Indians of the Southwest since the mid-1880s. Natalie certainly asked Lummis about the region's musical traditions and studied his notes and listened to his recordings. And she was certainly Lummis's most educated guest at the dance performance given by the Navajos at the Tournament of Roses celebration in Pasadena on New Year's Day, 1903. After several months in Southern California, Natalie was strong enough to go with George to Arizona. They left Los Angeles on the train bound for the southwesternmost corner of the United States, Yuma, Arizona. The seven-hour journey took them through snow-covered mountains and across a flat, cactus-studded desert near the Salton Sea. Exactly why they chose Yuma, in the very middle of the continent's largest, driest, hottest environment, the Sonoran Desert, is not known. Yuma was, in George's words, a humid hellhole, a town filled with the oft-scourings of Arizona, where the best and only lodging was found at the Hotel Gandolfo, where guests dined on rice and cabbage and paid a dollar a night for rooms that were not good. Lummis had traveled through the region and would have warned Natalie and George about spring on the desert. High noon in southern Arizona, the sun is a flood of infinite fire, wherein earth and sky are saturated. The heavens are an arch of burnished brass. The blinding landscape seems the thin crust over a sea of boiling lava. Touch a palm to that sand, and you shall acquire blisters as from a red-hot stove. The Colorado River and the green bosque that clung to the moisture found along its banks were the town's only inviting and attractive features. All travel around dusty, sunburned Yuma was by wagon, on horseback, or on foot. Natalie visited the state penitentiary and took notes for an article, but her interest from the start was not the so-called civilized side of the river, but the Native American community living on the reservation on the other side. The reservation of the Yumas, Quichan or Cochin, a Yuman-speaking tribe of desert farmers on the south side of the Colorado River, was the home to 600 Indians. Natalie was impressed by the Yuma's peaceful, self-contained community, and that not one of their members had ever been incarcerated in the state prison. In spite of their proximity to the town, she wrote in what was among the first of dozens of articles about the Southwest, these Indians are comparatively free from many of the vices unconsciously acquired by a primitive people who are ignorant of new temptations. Natalie was stepping into a world rarely glimpsed by Anglo-American women, the homeland of Native America. A few women had broken ground before her. Anthropologist-ethnologist Matilda Cox Stevenson had worked with her husband in the 1880s at Zuni and other New Mexico pueblos, and Alice C. Fletcher of the Peabody Museum had begun work in the 1880s among the Sioux. But as a single white woman of education and means, traveling at her leisure across Indian country, seeking to further her understanding of the Southwest's indigenous cultures, Natalie was a pioneer. 2. Land of ineffable light and sudden shadow. The moonlight flooded that great silent land. The senses were too feeble to take it in, and every time one looked up to the sky, one felt unequal to it, as if one were sitting deaf under the waves of a great river of melody. Willa Cather. When the Curtis siblings came to Yuma in the spring of 1903, their gear included a talking machine, an Edison phonograph and recorder that may have been given to Natalie in Los Angeles by Lummis. The dance songs performed with lusty vigor by the Navajos at the New Year's Day performance in Pasadena, coupled with Lummis's stories of the indigenous people he had met and recorded during his treks in the outback, had sparked Natalie's interest in native song, and she intended to go into the desert in search of music. Just as she had boldly introduced herself to the great maestros at the Met and gained admittance into the inner sanctum of Wagner's family home in Bayreuth, Natalie walked across the bridge that spanned the Colorado River and introduced herself to the Yuma Indians living on the other side. Who precisely served as her guide is not known, but when she crossed the river that day, Natalie began an exploration into the heart, mind, and music of Indian America that would become her passion and her vocation for the rest of her life. Natalie's initiation into the primitive world of Native America began with conversations with Indian elders. Chiparopi, also spelled Hiparopi in Natalie's writings, H-I-P-A-R-O-P-A-I, was an elderly Quichan woman who spoke English and Spanish. Like many Yumas, Chiparopi lived miles from the river and the white railroad town of Yuma, preferring the open desert where she could feel the air wide around me. Natalie met Chiparopi seated beneath a plum tree during one of the old woman's visits to relatives who lived by the wells. Natalie told Chiparopi that she was interested in understanding and knowing the Yuma people, and asked Chiparopi if she could take notes about their conversation. Chiparopi agreed and answered Natalie's questions with a blunt and poignant honesty. "Never mind if we are poor," the elder told Natalie in the shade of a thatched shed. "What good is life if we are not happy? White people think that money is everything. We Indians think that happiness is more." Natalie commented on Chiparopi's persistent racking cough and asked why so many Quichan were ill. "It seems as though you white folk bring poison to us Indians," the elderly woman answered. "Sickness comes with you, and hundreds of us die." The irony was not lost on Natalie. She and her brother George had come to the desert to be healed, to live. In her conversations with Chiparopi, Natalie learned how Indian Americans felt about Washington's assimilationist policies that banned their language, religion, and dress, and forcibly placed their children in government boarding schools. Especially brutalizing to Indian children was the Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA, strictly enforced practice of cutting off their long hair. Chiparopi also admonished white America's preference for stiff clothes and hard collars. Natalie assured Chiparopi that not all white people agreed with federal policies regarding Indian education. Natalie recorded Chiparopi singing Song of the Mockingbird and asked her about her tribe's spiritual beliefs. "How would we know how to live if we did not believe in something greater than ourselves?" the old woman asked Natalie. "And when we die?" Natalie asked. "Then it is all happiness," Chiparopi answered. "When we die, we are all alike." Natalie published an article in The Craftsman about her conversations with Chiparopi. She prefaced the story with a disclaimer that she, as the recorder, sought only to convey an individual Indian's opinions and thoughts about the changes brought to their world by the whites. She was not interested in conducting an academic study of Indian society or religious beliefs, but rather in learning who the people of Native America were and how they thought about their world and culture. She was also very interested in their music. "You want to know my people?" Chiparopi asked Natalie. "Live among them. See them in their fields, planting and harvesting. See them with their children. Hear them sing." Natalie took Chiparopi's counsel and with George traveled deeper into Indian country to find and hear the music of the native people. They boarded the train with the bulky Edison recorder and wax cylinders and several bags of gear and headed east across Arizona. George was comfortable traveling by horse and wagon, but the Arizona wilderness had few maintained roads in 1903, and the Curtis siblings traveled by train whenever possible. In his first years in the Southwest, George had lived and worked on a cattle ranch near Hauk, Arizona. The cowboy way and a life spent close to the land and far from people fit the former librarian's temperament, as his uncle George William Curtis had done in his formative years near Walden Pond. George DeCliver Curtis, nearly 30 when he came to Arizona, began to write. Unlike his uncle, George had no ambitions to become a career journalist and had little interest in achieving a name for himself. In 1914, George would publish his only novel, The Wooing of a Recluse, under the pseudonym Gregory Marwood. But George was a competent and thoughtful writer, and even when living in a tent in the outback, he regularly recorded his adventures and experiences in his diary. In 1903, guest ranches set up to accommodate Eastern dudes looking to play cowboy and to explore Indian country did not yet exist. Natalie's first experience among cowboys and cattle was at a working ranch, probably near Hauk, where life was a hand-to-hand tussle with an elemental world, shaped by scorching sun, wind, sudden cloudbursts, thirst, exhaustion, violent danger, loneliness, and isolation from the ties of home women. Unless Natalie and George were in a community like Yuma, along one of the railroads that cut across the territory, or were staying at one of the Protestant missions or government schools on the reservations, Natalie's living quarters that spring and summer were exactly the same as George's. I have ridden with cowboys, sung with them, seen roundups and bronco busting, spent months amid 1,000 head of cattle on one of the loneliest ranges in Arizona, devoid of all intercourse with the outside world, save for visits of wayfaring Indians or stray sheep herders seeking water at our springs. When the men left to ride the range, and I was alone in the cabin with a Colt revolver for companion, when I heard the plaintive sob of the wood pigeon in the cedars, the prelude to the choir of coyotes who would howl at the rising moon, when I realized that should any strange man try to enter, in which case I had been instructed to shoot, I might call forever, and though the sandstone cliffs might send back my voice, no human soul could hear or come. Then I understood the note of utter loneliness that sounds in many a cowboy song. Natalie could never have undertaken such adventures on the southwest frontier without her brother George. Just how much of their adventures were shared in letters sent to Bogey and Mimsy is unknown, but the details of her solitary nights in an isolated cabin with a Colt revolver to keep her company were certainly omitted from the siblings' missives to their family on Washington Place. From the cattle ranch near Hauk, George and Natalie went by horse and wagon, north and west, toward what the early Spanish explorers, and now the American anthropologists, called Tusayan, or Haupiland. Their destination, the ancient mesa-top village of Oribe, was a several-day journey across the Navajo Reservation through some of the most rugged, beautiful, harsh, and remote country in North America. Weather, the availability of water, and the physical condition and psychological stamina of brother and sister determined the speed and distance of their wagon's daily progress. After 2 days of slow progress across that Arizona wilderness of beauty, known as the Painted Desert, Hopi Third Mesa rose into view on the northwest horizon. The stone and mud pueblo of Oribe appeared carved from the stone island of Third Mesa, which soared 600 feet into the searing blue sky. Surrounded by an ocean of sand that fell away like waves into the four directions, the home of the Hopi, or Moki, was as exotic, primal, and spectacular as anything Natalie Curtis had ever seen. Oribe had a trading post as early as 1897, and by 1903, the U.S. government had built several buildings below Third Mesa, near the springs and wells that provided water to the natives. By midsummer, there would be small patches of green cultivated fields in the flat land below the village mesa. But in spring, the sand land boasted only small flecks of color that were the fragile desert wildflowers. The scarcity of water can hardly be conceived by those who have not been there, Natalie wrote, after her first visit to Hopiland. Every drop used in Oribe has to be brought for a distance of 2 miles, one half of which is up the steep trail, and carried all that long way in heavy earthen jars on the backs of toiling women. For nearly 1,000 years, the Hopis of Third Mesa, like their tribal neighbors on the cliff-top villages on First and Second Mesas, had hauled all of their water, food, and provisions on their backs up the trails carved into the stone to their homes on top of the mesa. The Hopi were a historically peaceful tribe. Their name means quiet people or people of peace. And for several hundred years they had managed to maintain a distance from European explorers and then American missionaries and other cultural invaders. But by the early 20th century, on Natalie's first visit to Oribe, the policies of the U.S. government had begun to erode Hopi independence, and the people of Tusayan regarded the white world as wicked, and white men, and most white women, as deceitful. Before Natalie and George departed Los Angeles in late January, Lummis may have suggested that their desert itinerary include a visit to the Hopi village of Oribe. At that time, Lummis's Sequoia League was launching a rigorous and covert campaign meant to undermine and expose the BIA's assimilationist policies sanctioned by Roosevelt's Secretary of the Interior, Ethan Allen Hitchcock. The League's efforts focused on the Superintendent of Indian Affairs, Charles E. Burton, at Keams Canyon on the Hopi Reservation. Stories about overzealous BIA agents kidnapping Indian children from their homes and dragging them off to the government school had Lummis and his friends up in arms. All of the solutions to the Indian problem in the United States after the Civil War advocated the same approach, the management and altering of savages into civilized Christian farmers. To implement the assimilation of Indians into the white world, the BIA opened boarding and day schools throughout Indian America. By stripping children of all outward signs of Indianness and introducing educational programs meant to undermine and weaken their cultural identity, the U.S. government meant to bring all Native Americans into the civilized fold of white America. Kill the Indian and save the man. The now infamous statement of Colonel Richard Henry Pratt, director of the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, pretty much summed up the federal government's agenda for Indians and Indian policy in the United States. To young Indians sent to one of the federal Indian schools, a white man's education meant learning to speak English and never ever speaking their native language while at school. Hair was cut short or shorn off completely, and traditional garments were burned and replaced by citizens' clothes, white people's trousers, shirts, and shoes. Every Indian student slept in a bed, prayed to Jesus, used a toilet, and ate only white food with a knife and fork. The remote, peaceable people of Hopiland were not spared the insensitive programs of the BIA, meant to eradicate their language, culture, and religion. In 1902, Indian Commissioner William A. Jones had sent out a letter to Indian agents and school superintendents, including Burton, which identified the native customs to be modified or eliminated. Long hair and traditional clothing were added to the government's formal list of forbidden behavior, which already banned use of native language or song in Indian schools. When the commissioner's rigorous instructions for assimilation of the Indians reached Burton at his office at Third Mesa, he instructed his agents to energetically, even brutally, enforce the reforms. In April 1903, as Natalie and George made their way in their wagon across the Arizona outback toward the country of the Hopis, Charles Lummis and Out West magazine launched a series of articles titled Bullying the Moki that specifically targeted the alleged atrocities perpetuated by Burton at his schools on the Hopi Reservation, especially at Keams Canyon. Lummis's inflammatory articles about Burton drew the attention of the White House. In May 1903, Lummis was granted time with Roosevelt on his presidential train as it traveled from the Grand Canyon to Los Angeles. Although Lummis had access to the president for almost two full days and presented in detail his grievances against Burton, Roosevelt was not ready to fire his superintendent of Indian Affairs. Lummis's Out West continued to publish stories about the mistreatment of Indian students at Burton's boarding schools. Most of Lummis's allegations of abuse were based on secret investigations by a woman named Gertrude L. Gates and on the testimony of an Oraibi schoolteacher, Belle Axtell Culp. Earlier in the spring of 1903, Lummis had dispatched Gates of Pasadena to Hopiland to collect information on Burton's activities. Gates posed as an invalid who had come to the high desert for her health, but Burton's agents became suspicious and confronted her. Gates confessed that she was in Hopiland to spy on Burton, and she was unceremoniously escorted off the reservation. Burton's office may have been leery of Gates because she appeared on the Hopi reservation just after the departure of Culp, who had publicly renounced Burton's education policies and resigned her teaching post in Oraibi in mid-February. Although Culp, also from Pasadena, was not one of Lummis's spies, her eyewitness accounts of the mistreatment of Indian children in government schools helped launch the Sequoia League's campaign against Burton. Culp was well-versed in frontier politics and politicians. Her uncle was Samuel B. Axtell, one-time governor of New Mexico and later the territory's chief justice. Upon her return to Pasadena, Culp wrote a lengthy deposition outlining government offenses against the Hopis at Oraibi. This deposition and her experiences as an Indian schoolteacher became the basis for a series of articles Lummis wrote and published in Out West magazine throughout the spring and summer of 1903. The BIA did investigate Burton's activities, but cleared the superintendent of most charges, and although the situation between the federal government and Native America, especially at Oribe, remained a tinderbox, and federal